This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We're celebrating 50 years of PBS this hour. We just spoke with Paula Kirger, PBS's longest-serving president and CEO, and now we're going to take a look at how the network became a pioneer in children's television. At first, kids' TV wasn't much more than puppets and grown men dressed as clowns. But that changed in the late 1960s when a bunch of New Yorkers realized you could harness TV to enrich kids' lives, not just entertain them. A book called Sunny Days, The Children's Television Revolution That Changed America by David Camp dives into the origin stories of public TV classics, to local kid shows, to short cartoon interstitials and how they flooded the airwaves in the 1970s to teach kids empathy, current events, and even grammar. I mean, how many of you learned about interjections from Reginald?
When Reginald was home with flu, the doctor knew just what to do. He cured the infection with one small injection while Reginald uttered some interjections.
Hey, that's smart! Ouch, that hurts! Yeah, that's not fair, giving a guy a shot down there!
Interjections,
hey!
Excitement,
yeah!
Emotion.
Ouch!
They're generally set apart from a sentence by an exclamation point or by a comma when the feeling's not as strong.
Sunny Days introduces us to the Mad Men who helped launch Schoolhouse Rock, how Sesame Street struggled to get diversity right, and how that girl, Marlo Thomas, and Ms. Magazine wanted to shape gender roles through kids' programming. David Camp is a Vanity Fair contributor and author of several books. He joined us in May when the book was published. There's a great story in the book about Lloyd Morissette, an experimental educator at the Carnegie Corporation, who found his three-year-old sitting in front of the TV, mesmerized by the test pattern. I began by asking David how this moment helped kickstart the emergence of educational TV.
Well, Lloyd Morissette's daughter, who I think was around three at the time, it was a Sunday morning, and he's awoken by this beep, which is the test pattern, and he's like following, what's this noise? It's his daughter just waiting for something to come on TV, and that was the best she could get. And so that's when he was a cognitive psychologist, and he says, oh my God, if a test pattern has this kind of power, what if educational TV could have even more power?
And so who did he connect with?
He connects with Joan Gans Cooney. Okay, so he has a friend named Julian Gans, whose cousin is Cousin Joni. And Julian Gans says, you two both live in New York, you should get together. So Lloyd Morissette and Joan Gans Cooney were friends, but not close friends. But one night in the winter of 1966, they have this dinner party, and Joan Gans Cooney is working for the precursor to WNET, Channel 13, and she's thinking, how can I help underprivileged kids? Poverty was her mission. And Lloyd Morissette's thinking, how can we harness the power of TV to help educate kids? And it was kind of one of that Reese's peanut butter cup, you put chocolate in my peanut butter moments where they realize it's the perfect match. What if we could harness the power of television to help kids learn? And in the beginning, it was primarily inner city kids that they were thinking about. But the idea, which grew into Sesame Street, was so successful that it reached pretty much every preschool kid in America.
Now, in the development of Sesame Street, there were psychologists and researchers. They were deployed to assess the episodes and how kids interacted with them. What findings had an impact on the way the show was produced?
Well, it was really important. And again, you have to bear in mind that they have pediatric psychologists and all sorts of educators and entertainment pros. And one thing that they learned, for example, is that the kids' attention was not held when it was just human beings in the street setting of Sesame Street. So that's when they introduced Oscar the Grouch and Big Bird, because they thought if the Muppets can intermix with the human characters, which at first they thought was beyond the pale, like kids' minds would be too blown by it. But in fact, kids were so TV literate in the late 60s and early 70s, they were like, yeah, this makes sense.
So what was particularly revolutionary about these characters like Oscar and Big Bird and Cookie Monster, about their characters?
Well, I'd say that they acknowledge the interiority of kids, which means the emotional intelligence. Big Bird was basically a proxy for an inquisitive three-year-old who has a lot of questions. Anyone who's raised a kid knows that phase when the kid just has nothing but why. You know, like, mm-hmm. You know, why is there a wall there? to keep us warm. You know, why do we have to be kept warm? Because we'll be cold weather. And so Big Bird is kind of that kind of kid. Oscar the Grouch is basically an acknowledgement that we don't always feel great, and we're going to run into other people who don't always feel great. So these are sort of like brilliantly executed pediatric psychology experiments.
Now, there was the complex case of Roosevelt Franklin, who was a black character created by Matt Robinson, who played Gordon on the show, who was a black man. Now, Roosevelt was beloved by some and considered problematic for others. What were the two reactions to Roosevelt Franklin?
Well, speaking personally, I can tell you that when I was a kid, Roosevelt Franklin was my favorite character on Sesame Street by far. He was dynamic, he was hilarious, he was purple, all good things in my opinion. However, there was an internal rift among the African-American executives at Children's Television Workshop, which produced Sesame Street. Matt Robinson's goal with Roosevelt Franklin was to present a character who African-American kids watching at home could see and say, I see myself, I see my family, in the way he talks, in the way his mother interacts with him. However, there were other people at Children's Television Workshop, like Jane O'Connor, a school teacher who was an advisor, and Evelyn Payne Davis, who was kind of the community outreach person for Children's Television Workshop. And they felt that it was putting out too, for lack of a better term, ghetto a portrayal of black people. They thought, this is what we are trying to get away from. And so Joan Ganz Cooney had to hear both sides of this argument. Should we keep Roosevelt Franklin or should he go? And ultimately, Jane O'Connor and Evelyn Payne Davis and their allies prevailed.
Something I think, by the way, my guest is David Camp. His new book is called Sunny Days, The Children's Television Revolution That Changed America. So there was this interesting moment in the book that you wrote about where Fred Rogers is not that sure about Sesame Street. He's not sure he's totally on board. And that Sesame Street, they're the kind of the New York hipsters, and he's thinking more suburban. What was his issue with Sesame Street?
Well, a lot of it was the pace, because if you watch Mr. Rogers, it's very mellow. The music is very languid. The conversation is very slow paced in a gentle way. I'm not belittling it at all. And Joan Ganz Cooney was unabashed about saying her influence in terms of Sesame Street's pacing was Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, which was this pop psychedelic comedy sketch show from the late 60s. And so Fred Rogers thought it literally was not his speed, Sesame mm-hmm. Street. He thought it was cognitively too much for kids to handle. And he thought some of the more slapsticky stuff was too raucous. Like there was a series of live action Jim Henson produced shorts about counting, which would always culminate in a baker tumbling down the stairs, which is great slapstick comedy to a lot of kids. But Fred Rogers made the point, a lot of young kids, they've only recently learned how to walk, and this might upset them. And this is one of those cases where you might think, oh, Fred Rogers, you're being so corny. But in fact, Sesame Street ultimately agreed with that assessment, and they stopped running the shorts with the baker falling down the stairs because they did get feedback that kids were upset by it.
You write about this great moment in front of the Subcommittee for Communications with Fred Rogers. And I found the clip. It's a little bit long, but I want to play it. It's in May of 1969, and Fred Rogers is testifying, trying to get money. And there's a certain congressman he has to appeal to. Can you set this up for us quickly, and then we'll listen?
Yes, this is Senator John Pastore, or it might be Pastore. Forgive me, I don't know. But he was a senator from Rhode Island. And Fred Rogers was appealing for the PBS budget not to be cut in half.
All right. And it's interesting because Pastore, not quite sure who Fred Rogers is, as you will hear. This is a little bit long, but it's worth it till the end.
I'm constantly concerned about what our children are seeing. And for 15 years, I have tried in this country and Canada to present what I feel is a meaningful expression of care.
Do you narrate it?
I'm the host, yes. And I do all the puppets, and I write all the music, and I write all the scripts.
Well, I'm supposed to be a pretty tough guy, and this is the first time I've had goosebumps for the last 2 days.
Well, I'm grateful not only for your goosebumps, but for your interest in our kind of communication. could I tell you the words of one of the songs which I feel is very important?
Yes.
This has to do with that good feeling of control, which I feel that the children need to know is there. And it starts out, "What do you do with the mad that you feel?" And that first line came straight from a child. I work with children, doing puppets in very personal communication with small groups. What do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong and nothing you do seems very right? What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up friends for a game of tag or see how fast you go? It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong and be able to do something else instead and think this song. I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop, stop, stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and know that the feeling is really mine. Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a lady, and a boy can be someday a man.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. Looks like you just earned the $20 million.
Such a classic clip. One is because that's Fred Rogers on fire. That's the my favorite part. David Camp is my guest. The name of his book is Sunny Days, The Children's Television Revolution That Changed America. So we see him there, you know, fighting for money. Who thought it wasn't a good idea to fund public television for children? Who fought against it?
Well, public television, this moment came out of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, when suddenly there was a big push to end poverty and to build out greater public systems for education and educational television. And then Richard Nixon became president in 1969, and it just became a debate, just like, you know, we have debates over everything. That they weren't against public television. There was actually pretty good bipartisan comedy, COMITY, back then. But nevertheless, it was a Republican president coming in after a Democrat and saying, do we really need to give them $20 million? Why can't we cut it to 10?
Let's talk a little bit about children's television that wasn't necessarily on public television. I was fascinated about the development of Free to Be You and Me. Marlo Thomas had just finished That Girl, and she was really appalled by gender stereotypes on television. So she spearheaded this project, Free to Be You and Me, but it was had an association with Ms. Magazine. Can you explain how they were connected?
Yes. Marlo Thomas had a niece which she was buying books for, and she couldn't believe how gendered and stereotypical the books were in their suggestion of a little girl can grow up to become a housewife and a boy can grow up to be a doctor. So she said she wanted to make it wasn't originally a television special. It was just a record album. And she was friends with Gloria Steinem and Letty Cotton Pogrebin, both of whom were feminists at Ms. And they got on House of Fire, and that's when the power of Ms., the Ms. Foundation, got behind this show. But then Free to Be You and Me became so successful as both a record and a TV show, and a book as well, actually, that the proceeds from the sales actually went to fund the Ms. Foundation. So it was kind of reciprocal success, that they fueled each other.
And I thought it was just really funny that the Pogrebin, is that the mother of the New York Times reporter?
Yes, Letty Cotton Pogrebin has twin daughters, Abby and Robin Pogrebin, and Robin, yes, is a reporter for the New York Times, and those twins are in the TV special Free to Be You and Me. If you see some twin girls who are around 6 at the time, that's them.
You have a great description of part of the television show, because Marlo Thomas was able to get all kinds of big stars to be involved. And there's this one clip where she and Harry Belafonte are kind of a couple traipsing around New York, and you write, Thomas and Harry Belafonte, looking more beautiful than any two human beings had the right to be, reprised parents or people in locations throughout a gorgeously autumnal New York City, with Thomas appearing as a cab driver, a hard-headed construction worker, and a doctor. Well, Belafonte appeared as an ice cream man, a baker, and a painter. Here's the song that accompanied that vision.
Some mommies are doctors.
Some daddies are bakers.
Or welders.
Or painters.
Or funny joke makers. Some mommies are umpires.
Some dads referees.
Yeah, mommies can be almost anything they wanna be.
What was going on culturally at this moment that allowed Free to Be You, well, and as popular as it was?
It was a moment when it was rife with possibility, because suddenly, I mean, Sesame Street had come on the air with a multiracial cast, which was brand new at the time. Black people appearing on television in regular slots was so rare that Jet Magazine on its last page every week used to have a page that said, like, who this week is black on TV? Like Michelle Nichols, Star Trek, NBC, 8:30. And suddenly you had a show, Sesame Street, where black people were regular members of the cast, in addition to Latin people and white people. Free to Be You and Me comes along with this cavalcade of celebrities of all races and both genders. Mm-hmm. And Harry Belafonte and Marlo Thomas singing this Parents Are People song is, on the one hand, a wonderfully encouraging symbol of the world that these kids are being welcomed into. But on the other hand, it was still grounds for controversy back then, because there was the suggestion that just maybe the Belafonte character and the Thomas character are a couple.
Oh, no. Not that.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
And for people
and there
local
was some blowback.
Oh, that's so interesting. For people in the area, they will recognize the voices of these two ladies, Carol and Paula. Matt, hit the clip.
It's nice to say hello, hola, hello, hola, hello, hola. It's nice to say hello, hello, and how are you? It's nice to shake your hands, shake hands, shake hands. It's nice to shake your hands, shake hands, and how do you do?
So those two ladies, are they a kind of, describe who they were and their role being feminists for little kids. The show is called The Magic Garden here in New York.
Yes, and it was a New York show, but because of the size of the audience it reached, it has an outsized prominence, almost like a national program. Carol Demus and Paula Janis were two girls, Brooklyn girls, who went to school together, and they just said to me when I interviewed them that being socially conscious just seemed like the right thing. No one forced us to do this. But in the early 60s, they were school teachers together in a Brooklyn school, a Brooklyn kindergarten that was terribly underserved, crumbling. And then they kind of went on with their lives separately for a while. Carol became the first Sandy in the first New York production of Grease. Paula became a Head Start program teacher, had a kid. But then WPIX, the local New York station, suddenly there was this obligation because of the Great Society that TV stations had to perform some public service programming. But they recruited Carol, who recruited Paula, and the result was this program.
That was my conversation with David Camp about his book, Sunny Days, The Children's Television Revolution That Changed America.